Hello, this is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin this week's Triangle Business Journal reading by looking inside the front cover at the biz page. And under the heading of Coming Back is the article, Raleigh Institution Gets Restored. One of downtown Raleigh's most iconic restaurants is nearly ready to welcome back customers. The Mecca, the 1930s-style diner at 13 East Martin Street, will reopen at the end of July, owner Greg Hatem says. The Mecca has undergone $150,000 to $200,000 worth of restoration work, says Hatem, the CEO of the Empire Eats Restaurant Group. The storefront was damaged last May in the wake of George Floyd protests, but has been restored to reflect its retro appeal. But in terms of menu items and the overall character of the restaurant, it feels pretty much the same, Hatem says. It's a Raleigh institution, and we're excited about bringing it back. Hatem was a regular at the restaurant before he bought it in 2018 from the Dumbalis family. Hatem also acquired the two-story, 2,300-square-foot building. And the heading of big number, the number is $110.5 million, which represents the total dollar sales for homes in New Hanover, Brunswick, and Pender counties for the month of May. That's the highest number ever for the red-hot coastal region. The previous record was set in March, and only $92 million. Under the heading of vaccination issue, the article, Cruises Crank Back Up, But Challenges Remain. Another good sign for the travel industry is cruises are set to return to U.S. waters in July. Carnival Cruise Line, the flagship brand of Miami-based Carnival Corporation, says it will resume cruises from Texas next month. Carnival Vista will set sail from the port of Galveston on July 3rd, followed by Carnival Breeze on July 15th. But the company could face a fight with Texas Governor Greg Abbott. Based on CDC guidelines, Carnival says passengers must be fully vaccinated. But Texas has passed a law that prohibits any Texas business or government entity from requiring vaccine passports. Meanwhile, Royal Caribbean said it will resume U.S. cruises starting July 2nd from Miami. But in a reversal, the company now says it will not require proof of vaccination. Florida has passed a law similar to the one in Texas. And under the heading of We Don't Have Paris, the article, Airlines Not Flying Back to Europe Yet. Biz has been quietly scheming to work from anywhere this summer while hanging out at a cafe in Paris, but sadly, those plans are being pushed back. Delta Airlines flight from Raleigh-Durham International Airport to Paris is tentatively scheduled to resume September 9th, according to a Delta spokesman. American Airlines isn't bringing back its nonstop flight to London this summer either, although an airline spokesman said tickets will go on sale August 17. Back in the spring, both airlines had hoped to crank the flights back up in May. Oh, well, time to cancel those dinner reservations at Le Procope. And under the heading of Rosemary Street comes the article, More Development for Chapel Hill. Compared to the bustle of Franklin Street, Chapel Hill's Rosemary Street has long been a more modest area, just to block off the main part of town, and a place that was home to bars such as Trolls, but that is changing, and rapidly. Charlotte developer Grubb Properties already has approval for a six-story office project on Rosemary Street. That's a project of significant scope in Chapel Hill, and it will rise above the much shorter buildings along Franklin Street that house places such as Sutton's. And now Grubb Properties seeks to add a seven-story apartment building to the site at 101 East Rosemary Street, the site of a former PNC bank, which Grubb Properties bought last month for $4.8 million. The land is currently zoned for just four stories, and Grubb Properties plans to request a zoning change. If approved, that part of town would undergo a transformation similar to what happened when the Carolina Square project changed West Franklin Street. And finally, on the biz page, under the heading of Hot Market, comes the article, Apartment Rates Back on the Rise. Last June, apartment occupancy in the Triangle slumped below 92% as the pandemic dragged into the summer. But this summer, rental rates in the Triangle are shooting back up, according to numbers from apartmentdata.com. Apartment rents in the market are now averaging $1,248 per month and have rocketed upward since the start of the year, when the average was around $1,160. Those rates are for an apartment of 967 square feet. Occupancy is running 93.2% as the Triangle continues to add units for its growing population. The website says the area opened 16 communities with 4,295 units in the past 12 months and has 10 communities with 2,594 units under construction. Even more stunning, there are 89 apartment communities with 24,867 units proposed to be built. Rental rates are topping out at $1.55, that's $1.55 per square foot per month, in downtown Raleigh, followed by $1.54 per square foot in Midtown, $1.33 per square foot in Crossroads, Apex, and Holly Springs. Well, we'll turn the page from the biz page, and we'll get to a little article here on the news page, and it's entitled New Pitch for Chatham County Site. A repositioned megasite in southeast Chatham County is being pitched as the region's next hub for life sciences. The Kaplan Companies of Denver has brought on JLL to begin marketing space at the group's 2,150-acre Triangle Innovation Point, previously known as the Moncure Megasite. Kaplan manages the site under Moncure Holdings, LLC. The site is 40 minutes from Raleigh and has been in development for more than a decade. It was one of the places state officials had pitched to Tesla for the location of a $1 billion gigafactory, which ultimately went to Texas. The name and rebranding come after the owners repositioned the site to focus more as a potential hub for tech and life sciences instead of traditional manufacturing. The company made the change last year with plans to begin work on the first buildings this year, though no tenants or end users have yet officially signed on for space at the park. The first phase of the project, Tip West, will make up 400 acres on the western portion of the park. It will be a joint venture between Samet Corporation, Lee Moore Capital, and a Denver-based family office, according to JLL. The remaining portion of the project, Tip East, will total 1,750 acres. Available sites will range from 10 to 1,000 acres, with property available for lease or purchase throughout the park. JLL Executive Vice President Matt Winters, Vice President Al Williams, and Capital Markets Director Sarah Godwin are handling the listing. Williams compared TIP to Research Triangle Park, with the former featuring larger parcel sizes and more accessible price points for smaller firms. While the park is targeting life science and tech companies, JLL is marketing the site to a wide variety of clients. The vision is to tap into where the market is today, says Godwin with JLL. If someone were to have a life sciences perspective, I think they'd get more attention from ownership because it's a higher level use. But they're not afraid of manufacturing and industrial needs as well. Well, we'll turn the page again and arrive at the banking and tech page. Under the heading of finance comes the article, Banks Diving into Digital. The digital tide is accelerating in North Carolina's banking industry. Could consolidation follow? In the months following the pandemic's peak, banks are taking the hint and investing in more digital solutions as their customers look to operate remotely. A case in point is nCino, that's spelled N-C-I-N-O, a banking technology startup out of Wilmington. The firm saw a sizable increase in new customer business for the first time since the start of the pandemic, reflecting the financial institution's increased demand for digital solutions across their product portfolio, CEO Pierre Nord recently told analysts. But keeping up with the trend takes cash. Will small banks be able to keep up? Chris Marinac, director of research for Atlanta's Janney Montgomery Scott, says it's a trend he's seeing across the industry. And for some banks, it could mean consolidation opportunities. In the past few weeks, multiple deals have been announced. First Bank of Southern Pines plans to buy Select Bank and Trust of Dunn. And United Bank shares disclosed plans to buy Virginia-based Essex Bank. Marinac says the digital divide isn't forcing banks to consolidate, but it is making an exit more enticing for investors looking to get out of the industry. Financial technology solutions are getting cheaper, meaning staying independent is more about gumption than capital, Marinac says. Raleigh-based Dogwood State Bank, for example, is pushing to be a statewide institution primarily through technical reach and not physical branches, he says. Marinac sees the accelerating digital trend as actually an opportunity for smaller institutions looking to make the leap. The technology is such that any small bank has, in my opinion, a more level playing field, he says. Technology makes it easier for a community bank to stay in business. And under the heading of forecasting comes the article, Raleigh to play key role for weather startup on heels of $100 million raise. With a $100 million funder, a new weather intelligence company is emerging from stealth mode and centering its engineering efforts in Raleigh. Climavision, based in Louisville, Kentucky, announced a $100 million financing round from TPG's impact investing arm, the Rise Fund. CEO Chris Good says Raleigh, where the firm is running its research and development office, will be a big part of the story. Raleigh was chosen primarily due to the location of its research team. Peter Childs, the firm's chief scientist, lives in the Triangle, Good says, but the hope is that it will also serve as an ideal recruitment location. Raleigh will be a very strategic part of our business, he says. R&D is at the heart of what we're doing. Climavision hopes to change the landscape of weather forecasting by bringing together a weather radar and a satellite network with new prediction modeling tools. Good says most of the current landscape relies on existing government data, and there are only so many ways to interpret the same information. Climavision applies its own proprietary data to that information for a more accurate forecast, he says. And in a very short article here on the heading of under the heading of aviation is Atlanta is top June RDU destination. Traffic is coming back to Raleigh-Durham International Airport, meaning airlines are scheduling more flights ahead of the summer season. And data show the destinations that are expected to see the most travelers. With planned flights totaling more than 61,000 seats, Atlanta has the most popular route out of RDU this month. That's according to aviation data firm OAG, which put Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport at the top of the list of busiest RDU routes for June. And there's a small bar graph that accompanies this article showing that Atlanta does indeed have 61,000 seats. And then following that is Charlotte with 39,800, Orlando with 31,100, Dallas-Fort Worth with 25,200, Denver with 23,700, Chicago with 21,400, Fort Lauderdale just under 21,000 at 20,900, Boston 18,000, Philadelphia a little less at 18,002, Las Vegas 15,800. And we turn the page again and we arrive at the healthcare page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of key location, we find the article Filling a Gap at North Hills. Gilead Sciences grabs major office space as Allscripts shrinks. A big-name pharmaceutical company is grabbing vacant office space in a prominent North Hills building. Triangle Business Journal previously reported that Allscripts moved employees out of the 7th through 9th floors of the Midtown Plaza building. Now it appears that the space at 305 Church at North Hill Street has been taken. Sources tell TBJ that California-based Gilead Sciences has signed a lease with Kane Realty to fill all three floors. The company did not respond to requests for comment. The pharmaceutical giant announced in February it would be launching a new business services center in Wake County with an investment of up to $5 million. That project is expected to bring 275 jobs with average salaries of $142,000, more than double Wake County's current average salary of $63,000. The company is actively recruiting for the local positions on LinkedIn. The three floors that were up for sublease in the Allscripts building can more than accommodate that many workers. Cushman & Wakefield's advertisement for the space listed the 8th and 9th floors as having 28,061 square feet apiece and a total of 370 workstations. The 8th floor has 208 stations, while the 9th floor has 162. Combined with the 7th floor, the space amounts to 84,000 square feet. When announcing the Triangle expansion in February, Gilead, which developed the COVID-19 treatment Remdesivir, said that having the business services center in the Triangle allows it to realize certain cost and time zone advantages. The center will house several critical functions for the company, including human resources, financial services, IT, and procurement services. The company said it also expects the center to be fully operational in the third quarter of 2021, when it will begin moving employees on site. And another small article here on the healthcare page, under the heading of Certificate of Need, comes the article, Doctor Not Giving Up Fight Against NC Healthcare Regulations. A Newbern doctor's lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the state's Certificate of Need, that's a CON law, has been dismissed by a judge in Durham County. But the plaintiff's lawyers say they will appeal the decision. The CON law allows the state to regulate the development of new healthcare services and facilities. The goal is to control cost and preserve access to healthcare. Ophthalmologist Jay Singleton filed the suit against state officials and the NC Department of Health and Human Services, which enforces the law. His case argues Conlon is in violation of the state's constitution, conferring monopoly rights to established healthcare providers to the detriment of smaller providers that could offer more affordable services. The judge dismissed the case, saying he was bound by the precedent set by the state's Court of Appeals in a case brought by Asheville-based Hope Women's Center, Cancer Center about a decade ago. Joshua Windham, an attorney representing Singleton, said he believed the Hope case did not apply in this situation because Singleton is challenging the law on different grounds. Well, we'll turn the page again, and we arrive at the real estate page. And the lead article on the real estate page, under the heading of Downtown, is Nexus Development in Raleigh could swell to 40 stories. The group behind a major project in downtown Raleigh plans to request a zoning change in the coming weeks to allow for development up to 40 stories. The acquisition group is seeking the rezoning at 215 South McDowell and 123 West Target Streets, known as the site of the Nexus. The 3.3-acre site is among the most prominent in the city, sitting across from Nash Square in the heart of downtown. The McDowell Street property serves as the headquarters of the News and Observer before the newspaper moved its offices in 2017 to One City Plaza. The site is currently zoned for up to 20 stories of development. The acquisition group of Santa Ana, California, bought the site for $22 million in 2017. After purchasing the property, the company bought on Chapel Hill-based the company brought on Chapel Hill-based East West Partners as a development partner and began working on designs for the project. In 2019, the group unveiled its vision for 1.5 million square foot development featuring 4 mixed-use towers up to 20 stories each. The company later released plans for a 20-story office tower and 20-story condo project to make up 2 phases of the development. At the time, the group said they hoped to begin work in 2020, but that was pushed back and has yet to begin. It's unclear what this latest move to rezone the property means for the previously released designs or for the project as a whole. The acquisition group did not immediately return requests for comment. East West Partners declined to comment on the new rezoning request. The company is still the partner on the development, though the acquisition group is pursuing the zoning change on its own. Morningstar attorney Mac Paul is representing the group in the request and says the filing is meant to give additional flexibility for the future development. The overall vision has not changed, Paul says. And under the heading of new owner comes the small article, Martin Marietta sells former headquarters for $17.6 million. A major aggregates company in Raleigh has sold its former headquarters to a local investor. Martin Marietta sold 2 office buildings near UNC Rex Hospital for $17.6 million. The buyer is Raleigh-based CPG JRC Wycliffe Road LLC. The LLC is addressed to Chartwell Property Group, a Raleigh real estate investment and development firm, whose managing partners are Jack Dunn and Roger Perry. The deal was completed in late May. The project is situated on 11.5 acres at 2700 Wycliffe Road off Lake Boone Trail and next to a Food Lion-anchored shopping center. Martin Marietta has moved its headquarters to the new Glen Lake 7 building in the Glen Lake Office Park off Edwards Mill Road near Crabtree Valley Mall. Plans for the move were announced in early 2020. Glen Lake 7 features 5 stories, totaling 125,000 square feet of Class A office space. Martin Marietta acquired the Wycliffe Road site for $2.8 million in 1994, according to Wake County records. Built in 1982, the buildings combined feature around 165,000 square feet of office space. The property has an assessed value of $24 million, according to county records. And we'll turn the page again and reach the retail and restaurants page. And the major article on this page is, "This bank is tapped out." After years of work, craft beer will soon be flowing at a former bank building in Raleigh. Vault Craft Beer is set to open at 518 West South Street near Boylan Heights in Lake Fall after more than 3 years of planning and work. Construction recently began after co-owners Greg Kelly and Eric Kern obtained building permits from the city to turn the former site of a 1950s-era bank into a bar. The bar will serve beer from across the state and have 18 taps available. The owners are working with Raleigh Construction Company to update the 1,100-square-foot building, originally designed by local architect Fred Carter Williams. The location was a First National Bank and one of the first drive-through banks in the area. Kelly and his wife, Laura, bought the property for $550,000 in 2016. They also own a 1940s-era gas station nearby, which they plan to restore in the future. Changes to the bank building included turning the drive-through lane on the west side of the building into a canopy-covered outdoor seating area. The interior will feature table and bar seating. There will also be space on the property for food trucks. So far, nearly $30,000 has gone toward efforts to preserve the property, including developing a site plan to ensure compliance with the city's development code, Greg Kelly says. "That's just the amount we burned through to save this building because we weren't tearing it down to the ground," Kern says. "We found it particularly challenging trying to save this bank, realizing its historic nature. People who haven't tried to save a property don't realize the hidden costs that are there." another $300,000 to $350,000 will be needed for a fitting and renovation, plus about $80,000 more for furniture and fixtures. Kelly owns retro mailbox manufacturing company Modbox USA, and Kern works alongside Kelly at the Raleigh-based business. Well, let's turn the page again, and we arrive at the Executive Voice page. And this week's Executive Voice belongs to Kathy Bradrick. Bradrick is the Senior Vice President of Resourcing Operations for Catalyst Clinical Research. As you know, the Executive Voice page is a Q&A feature, and Triangle Business Journal poses some questions, and our executive provides her answers. Kathy Bradrick started working in the clinical research organization industry more than 20 years ago, before it grew into the behemoth it is today. Catalyst Clinical Research, where she currently works, has continued to grow at a clip since its inception in 2013, growing from a staff of 4 to 500, and revenue of $8 million in 2016 to $63 million in 2020. COVID-19 created a momentous overnight hurdle for an industry built on face-to-face interactions. While some transitions that resulted from COVID, such as the move to decentralized trials, are here to stay, Bradrick sees other aspects of the industry returning to a semblance of normalcy post-pandemic. So here are the questions and answers. What opportunities and challenges do you see in the CRO space now? COVID has brought on several challenges and opportunities for the CRO industry. The industry essentially had to pivot to focus on vaccines and treatments for COVID, while trials for other therapeutic areas and indications came to a screeching halt. The industry had many challenges, whether clinical science sites would be open and accessible to patients, if patients would be willing to go to clinical sites for non-life-threatening illnesses, would sites allow outsiders in to monitor clinical trials? Restricted travel that limited trial activities for both patients and industry professionals, and many more. Tools and systems for decentralized trials and remote monitoring existed prior to COVID, but adoption of them was slow before COVID forced the issue. In a way, it's been the disruption the industry needed to embrace changes to the traditional ways things were done. So how do you see that impacting operations in the long term? Her response, I believe the industry will embrace the changes that came about, but also expect that some things will return to the traditional in-person ways. Some tasks, such as study material reconciliation, inspection for fraudulent activities, and regulatory document review, are more effective in person, as is motivating the sites for enrollment in clinical trials. So what's your role in bringing clinical trials together? I started in the industry as a business analyst as I was finishing grad school when the industry was fairly young, and gained a lot of valuable experience in the trenches when a lot of the industry infrastructure and practices were in early development. I was also lucky enough to work with some amazing people that have mentored me and been instrumental in my career development. My career has taken a few twists and turns. My knowledge base and relationships have been key to my success. I always knew I wanted to help people grow in their careers, and as a result, I gravitated toward the resourcing roles I've been in later in my career. So what would you say are your biggest accomplishments? Her answer, encouraging people to come into the industry, matching skill sets with industry opportunities, helping people grow their careers, helping clients get the right resources they need to run their studies and programs. What books are you reading right now? Her response, before COVID, I traveled a lot, and airplane time was my reading time. Haven't done a lot of reading recently. However, I've watched several interesting series and shows. A few things I recently completed include The Handmaid's Tale, Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel, and The Crown. Well, we turn the page once more, and we reach this week's cover story, which is entitled, Red Hat Now, the Epicenter of IBM's Future. Is IBM considering a headquarters move to Raleigh? No. At least that's the word from the IBM leaders in Armont, New York. Despite the investments, new hires, and cloud technology focus, the company is shoveling toward the city of Oaks. Jim Whitehurst, the former CEO of Red Hat and current president of IBM, can't help but call it an enticing area, though. Speaking at a press conference in May, the Triangle resident joked that, if you were asking me, you might get a different answer. We have a lot going on, he said. We're worried about getting people returned to work. We'll worry about facilities in the future. But 2 years after technology's biggest deal, what's clear is IBM is turning red. IBM reported revenue of $17.7 billion for the first quarter, up 1%. But Red Hat revenue was up a whopping 17%, according to the company's latest financials. Regardless of any potential HQ switch, more and more technology observers who follow Big Blue and the impact Red Hat is having on the giant tech company's top line agree Red Hat is going to play a bigger role with every quarter as cloud computing becomes the mainstay to connect businesses. And having one of IBM's largest campuses in the world inside Research Triangle Park and near the downtown Raleigh Red Hat Tower may already have paid dividends for Big Blue. The biggest argument for a headquarters move could be made in terms of cost. IBM has been cost-cutting, aggressively looking to streamline what's not working in order to fund its high-growth businesses, cloud, and artificial intelligence. And an argument can be made that being in New York is not working for fiscally-minded companies, says economic development expert John Boyd of the Boyd Company. New York's corporate income tax rate is 7.25%, compared to North Carolina's 2.5%. Other state business taxes like workman's compensation and unemployment insurance are also significantly higher in New York State, Boyd says. Add to this a much more favorable tort system and labor climate, including right-to-work legislation in North Carolina, which is not in effect in New York. In recent months, some businesses have moved their headquarters to the Triangle primarily to capitalize on savings, such as Avaya and Phreesia. Tech firm Avaya quietly relocated from California last year, but largely on paper, as its headcount is primarily remote with the pandemic, and many of its executives live elsewhere. Like IBM, it had long had a presence in the region, having acquired Nortel's assets a decade earlier. Health-focused firm Phreesia made a similar move, designating its physical headquarters is now in downtown Raleigh instead of New York, while keeping much of its headcount in the Big Apple. It's unclear how much money the companies save with a move, but that's just one of the benefits. When Advance Auto Parts formally agreed to move its headquarters to Raleigh in 2018, it finagled a deal for $12.5 million in incentives. While Advance Auto already had an executive team and sizable headcount growing in Raleigh, with or without the headquarters designation, state officials jumped at the opportunity for an official Fortune 500 address, aware of the economic development prestige its presence would bring. And the state's Economic Investments Committee has not been shy about incentives this year, having recently approved Apple for a record $846 million in potential reimbursements. And state officials would likely step up again for a project as high profile as an IBM headquarters. When comparing each state's economic development program, its experience, professionalism, and business acumen, New York's program plays checkers, while North Carolina's very winning program tends to play chess, Boyd says. It continues on a roll, especially in the tech and the life sciences sectors. But economic developers say it's talent, not dollars, that closes headquarters deals for North Carolina. Lee Perry, senior managing partner for East West Partners, and currently working on Bandwidth's new Raleigh headquarters, says there's plenty of interest from technology companies in the Triangle, and that it comes down to talent. He points to Apple, which recently committed to bringing more than 3,000 jobs to RTP as just one example. More and more companies are seeing the region as a place that makes sense for a lot of reasons, he says, noting the talent base, universities and research, the affordability we still have compared to many other markets. Chris Chung, CEO of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, says each new economic development announcement can be leveraged into even more interest from technology firms. Tech firms in particular want to be somewhere where they know the talent is. And as IBM likely knows from being in RTP for so long, the talent is here. For IBM, the red tide is coming, with or without a Raleigh address. IBM closed on its $34 billion buy of Red Hat 2 years ago on July 9, 2019, on the promise of creating the leading hybrid cloud provider in the world. As the leading hybrid cloud provider, we will help clients forge the technology foundations of their businesses for decades to come, then CEO Gina Rometty said at the time. And the deal has delivered, according to both analysts and company executives. CEO Arvind Krishna pushes hybrid cloud as a constant bragging point on earnings calls, and Red Hat Tower can't help but notice. Certainly, if you look at the things that Arvind Krishna says on earnings calls, the focus on IBM is now hybrid cloud and AI, says Mike Ferris, Senior Vice President of Corporate Development and Strategy at Red Hat. Red Hat is the hybrid cloud component of that. They bet big on the success of Red Hat. The deal has delivered so much that IBM has gradually been taking bigger and bigger bets on hybrid cloud, realigning its sales strategy to put more of an emphasis on Red Hat, and recently announcing the pending spin-out of its managed services business. It's chipping away at legacy IBM and funneling more attention on what's working today. And quarter by quarter, it's clear that what's working is Red Hat, centered not at IBM's legacy headquarters campus in New York, but at Red Hat Tower in downtown Raleigh. And the pandemic has only heightened that focus. What we've seen through this pandemic is really an acceleration of clients' digital transformations and journeys to cloud, Chief Financial Officer Jim Cavanaugh said at a J.P. Morgan conference in May. And if you look at it, we've actually been capitalizing on that. Enterprise-based spending rebounded in the firm's first quarter, in particular around hybrid cloud, around Red Hat, he said. For its first quarter, IBM's revenue of $17.7 billion included total cloud revenue of $6.5 billion. You effectively have the first quarter of growth before foreign exchange impacts in a year. Now, that's a big deal for IBM, Edward Jones analyst Logan Perk says. For its last full year, IBM reported $73.6 billion in revenue, down about 5%. But Red Hat, which it bought out 2 years ago, saw its revenue increase 18%. Red Hat is simply where the growth is. One particular sticking point when the deal was announced was the so-called wall IBM would put around Red Hat. While IBM would upsell Red Hat, Red Hat would need to keep its neutrality so that it could continue to work with IBM competitors. And its ability to maintain that neutrality got some of the most blunt questions at forums, both internal and analyst events, when the deal was announced. Ferris says IBM had respected the wall, while IBM has allowed Red Hat to use its girth and synergies in addressing our mutual customer needs. It's allowed Red Hat to keep its neutrality in place, he says, and it's worked out because as Red Hat grows, IBM grows as well. Ferris says it has just been good business strategy. With such a high price tag on the deal, IBM has extra impetus in ensuring Red Hat's success, he says. Analyst Pert takes us a step further. IBM has bet the farm on Red Hat and needs the deal to deliver for the sake of Big Blue's entire future. There is no backup plan. While Big Blue as a business has aligned around Red Hat, so too has the culture, Kavanaugh said at the J.P. Morgan event. IBM has pulled in its entrepreneurial mindset, he added. Ferris said Big Blue has made a concerted effort to keep Red Hat's culture. early on. Analysts said that commitment to culture would be key in the deal's success. For IBM's hybrid cloud vision to be realized, it needed Red Hat team members on board, a team that for decades had prided itself on its open source culture. And the culture component appears to be working, as Red Hat has grown locally since the closure of the deal. For Red Hat, the roadmap hasn't changed. We're just accelerating it, Ferris says. Now we'll take a few minutes to wander around the remainder of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the article Around the State, under the heading Around the State, comes the article LendingTree moving its new local headquarters in Charlotte's South End. LendingTree Incorporated is ready for the post-pandemic era with a fresh headquarters office opening in South End. The first wave of employees will start moving in this month. LendingTree's 176,000-square-foot office spans 5.5 floors at Vantage South End, an approximately $300 million development that will include two 11-story office buildings, retail space, and a boutique hotel. Construction has begun on the second office building. The firm's office has just over 770 employee workstations and 16 private executive offices. There are 64 conference rooms, half of which are catering equipped, plus more than two dozen other collaboration spaces. The new office at 1415 Vantage Park Drive is a mix of residential and commercial design, including the furniture for a more comfortable feel, says Kelsey Tennyson, a special projects associate at LendingTree. Workspaces have plenty of natural light. There are phone rooms, all-gender bathrooms, wellness and meditation spaces, and suites for nursing mothers. The conference rooms, all with Zoom capabilities, are labeled based on per-floor themes, including songs, movies, landmarks, artists, and innovators. LendingTree, an online lending marketplace, did not provide an exact cost of the investment. It pledged in 2018 to invest more than $26 million in a headquarters expansion in Mecklenburg County. That investment was also to lead to 436 new jobs in a five-year period. The company expects to add 500 jobs from this year to 2024. It already has more than 1,200 total employees, about half of whom are based in Charlotte. The median salary for all employees is $107,322. Tennyson says employees ask for other seating options beside their workstations. There is a more relaxed alternative spot for each employee to use. Floors have treehouse areas with more open workspace. Other features include a studio, a music room with pentagon-level soundproofing, a soon-to-be game room, libraries, custom wall murals, and outdoor patios. We're really encouraging people to take meetings outside of conference rooms, just as a reflection of LendingTree's culture being open and candid, Tennyson says. About 10 employees are currently working in the South End office. More people who volunteered to return to the office will be settling in soon. That first group can further test out the space and provide feedback, Tennyson says. LendingTree will start its first official return to office phase in July. Employees can voluntarily come back if they are fully vaccinated. There are no capacity restrictions at this point. The pandemic has led to financial challenges at LendingTree. However, executives started to see some recovery in the firm's consumer businesses late last year. Company leaders said on a first quarter earnings call, they expect LendingTree's personal loan and credit card businesses to keep improving throughout 2021. Its insurance division also continues to grow. The firm's home segment has performed well in a booming market. In April, LendingTree announced changes to its overall structure and leadership team. The company has organized into three sectors: core marketplaces, insurance, and LendingTree Next. Neil Salvage, Scott Perry, and J.D. Moriarty are heading up those respective sectors. Trent Ziegler took over as Chief Financial Officer. And under the heading of hiring comes the article, Nonprofits Look to Be Creative as Jobs Begin to Return. In recent weeks, many local businesses have had difficulty filling vacant positions. Nonprofits are also feeling the effects of this labor market shortage, as evidenced by the wealth of open positions on nonprofit job boards and the recent report from the Johns Hopkins Center for Civil Society Studies, estimating that it will take another 18 months for a full recovery of nonprofit jobs to pre-pandemic levels. While the state policymakers are weighing a variety of government solutions to help address the labor market, many nonprofits are being proactive in finding ways to make employment at their organization attractive. The current labor market challenges have developed quickly as a growing number of North Carolinians are vaccinated, and many nonprofits and businesses are returning to more normal operations. Just over a year ago, policymakers were seeking solutions to a much different problem: the widespread loss of jobs that resulted from the first wave of COVID-19 cases. Last March, Congress established 6 temporary unemployment programs to help workers who had been laid off or furloughed because of the pandemic. 1, a federal supplement payment of $300 per week to unemployed workers. 2, extension of the duration of unemployment benefits to a total of 53 weeks. 3, expansion of unemployment coverage to self-employed workers and staff of religious or very small nonprofits. 4, supplemental payments of $100 per week for mixed earners who are self-employed but also are receiving unemployment benefits from staff positions. 5, waiver of the one-week waiting period for unemployment benefits. And lastly, federal coverage for 3/4 of the cost of unemployment claims for nonprofits and local governments that elect to self-insure rather than pay state unemployment taxes. The American Rescue Plan Act, ARP, extended these programs through September the 6th. Now, some states are seeking policy changes to try to combat perceived labor market shortages. Over the past 4 weeks, governors in 26 states have opted to withdraw from some or all of these 6 federal unemployment programs in hopes that workers will seek employment more quickly without this supplemental federal support. In North Carolina, Governor Roy Cooper doesn't seem inclined to cancel federal unemployment benefits early. However, state policymakers are considering a variety of approaches to help businesses and nonprofits fill vacant positions. The North Carolina House of Representatives recently approved a bill that would withdraw North Carolina from the federal program providing $300 weekly supplemental payments. The North Carolina Senate has taken a different approach, approving legislation to provide $1,500 payments to workers on unemployment who find jobs within 30 days and $800 payments to workers on unemployment who find an employment within 60 days. And other state legislators have proposed alternative ways of removing barriers for some workers to return to the workplace by increasing access to child care and raising the state's minimum wage to $15 an hour. It remains to be seen whether any of these policy changes will become law this summer. Nonprofits and businesses shouldn't need to rely exclusively on government solutions to help fill vacant positions. Here are 3 things nonprofit leaders have been doing to make their organizations more attractive to potential employers. 1, offer competitive wages and benefits. 2, encourage people to volunteer. 3, be creative, flexible. Business leaders may want to consider each of these nonprofit solutions as they look for ways to gain a competitive advantage in finding new talent in the current labor market. Now we turn to the back of this week's Triangle Business Journal, where we find the viewpoint page, and we find at the top of the page the editor's notebook, which is entitled this week, Could Diversity Initiatives Determine Profitability? On a recent trip back from Texas, I was sitting beside a gentleman who runs what he called a successful molding company out of Indiana with sales of about $40 million and 90 workers. Talking about his business and the outlook going forward, he mentioned one of his biggest customers recently asked him for a written document listing his board members and management personnel. The customer had never asked for that information in the decade-plus relationship. Since the company was private without any structured board makeup, He gave the names of seven individuals he considered a part of his management team. There were seven men and one woman in that group, and among them was one Hispanic male. He believes his largest customer is reviewing all its vendor relationships and the diversity of the companies before renewing contracts. Stories like this are about to become the norm, and companies of all sizes better get ready to answer some questions if they want to expand their business. After years of extreme disparity where whites made up the supermajority of boards and management teams, 2020 may be remembered for more than just the year of the pandemic. Most of the nation's biggest corporations are now strongly advocating for a sea change in the way they set their boards and management teams. Some have even said the future hiring of rank-and-file workers may have to undergo changes. While all this has to be executed legally without running into discriminatory issues regarding sex and racial and ethnic makeup, many corporations already have taken some bold actions. ISS Corporate Solutions, known by ICS, a provider of compensation, governance, and sustainability tools and advisory services to help companies improve shareholder value and reduce risk, recently came out with a report stating nearly a 200% increase in the count of newly appointed S&P 500 board members who are black. According to ICS, between last July and this May, 32% of all newly appointed directors were black, while just over one half, 54%, were white. Those figures stood at 11 and 74% respectively in the previous 12 months. These corporations that control trillions of dollars in contract work awarded to mid-sized and small businesses may soon require every vendor of significance to detail their management and workforce makeup. The goal? To change the makeup of companies. If companies resist making changes, they're likely to be overlooked in favor of companies that embrace and accept the inevitable. The movement to address the challenges facing us in the field of diversity, equality, and inclusion may now begin to seep into the SME sector. Now, SME is small and medium enterprises with $10 million to $1 billion in sales, and eventually the SMB sector. And those are small and medium-sized businesses with revenue of $5 to $10 million. Despite the progress, obviously much work needs to be done. For example, a recent analysis by Deloitte and the Alliance of Board Diversity concluded that only 18% of board members at Fortune 500 companies are black. About 21% are women, 62% are white men. In 2010, white men accounted for 75% of all board seats. To execute a meaningful change, the shift has to come from the SMEs and the SMBs that create the largest number of jobs every year. According to the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Advocacy, small businesses, that's companies under 500 workers, have generated 64% of net new jobs over the past 15 years. Diversity is not just a word anymore for companies. There are measurables and there are consequences. As you know, the Viewpoint page always has a guest columnist, and this week's guest column is written by Joe Malio, who is the CEO of McKinney Ad Agency in Durham. His last name is M-A-G-L-I-O, and so if I'm mispronouncing it, I certainly hope he'll accept my apology. And the article's entitled, "For Apple, Google, the Triangle Offers New Ideas." Durham's national profile has been rising steadily for the last 15 years or so. It popped even higher with the announcement that Google's creating a new engineering hub downtown. And on the heels of the Google news came word of Apple investing over $1 billion to build a new campus in the Triangle. As CEO of McKinney, an ad agency with offices in Los Angeles and New York, but whose headquarters have remained in Durham since 2004, I'm excited to welcome our new neighbors. These two moves are undoubtedly another tipping point for the Triangle, and almost certainly transformative. But the benefits here are a two-way street. For as big and powerful and influential as these Silicon Valley megastars are, if they're smart, they'll realize how much in the Triangle can influence them, and in an entirely positive way. McKinney has seen a lot of change here in the Triangle in its 52-year history, and we created more than a little bit ourselves when our founder, Charles Chick McKinney, decided to open the agency in downtown Raleigh, eschewing what industry insiders considered the sine qua non of agencies setting up shop on Madison Avenue, because he believed that the dynamism he saw in Raleigh and across the Triangle could lead to big things for companies of all stripes. But my reference point is my own experience. I started at McKinney in 2017, having spent my entire career in the New York offices of larger agency networks such as Ogilvy, Publicis, and Havas. I've also spent my entire life living in New York or within a reasonable daily commute. And as the first CEO in McKinney's 50-plus year history to not live in North Carolina, I still benefit from the perspective of someone frequently coming into the Triangle region from elsewhere in the country. It wasn't until I'd made several trips to Durham that I realized how much of McKinney's culture is shaped by the Triangle itself. I came to understand why Chick McKinney believed it was not only possible to start a world-class agency outside of Madison Avenue, but there were inherent advantages in doing so, like access to a rising generation of talented graduates and creative thinkers in the newly formed Research Triangle Park, a lower cost of living, and a less stressful lifestyle. Ultimately, I agree with those who see the Triangle as another shining example of the Goldilocks effect. Not too this or that, just right. It's big enough to attract world-class resources and compete on a national level, but small enough to have a strong community feel. It's urban enough, even for many big city expats, but a 20-minute drive in any direction will put you in the middle of sweet tea-infused small towns and rich farmland. The demographic makeup is diverse, perhaps the perfect indicator of where the country is headed. The list goes on and on, regardless of category, religious affiliation, levels of education, climate, arts, proximity to beaches and mountains, and everything in between. It's even politically balanced, evidenced by numerous individual issues and also by state government with power split between parties. In essence, the Triangle's America. There's no better place to set up shop to innovate, create, test, and learn. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it and will be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. So have questions or comments? Call us, 919-832-5138. So long, till next time.